we get things underway in hour two this afternoon by welcoming to the program a writer whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New Yorker, Slate, The Daily Beast, and more. He is the author of a wonderful new book entitled Our Team, the epic story of four men and the World Series that changed baseball. We're happy to say hello to Luke Eplin. Luke, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I love this book so much. It was a tremendous read. What was it that drew you to the story of this 1948 Cleveland Indians team and really the journey that led up to it?
Well, it's kind of a long route there. I'm not from Cleveland. I'm from St. Louis. I had no connection to Cleveland whatsoever. This book takes a look at four different men that are involved in the Cleveland championship, one of whom is named Bill Veeck. Bill Veeck was the last owner of a team called the St. Louis Browns. This was an old major league team that eventually became the Baltimore Orioles. My grandfather was a huge fan of the St. Louis Browns back during World War II. He used to tell me stories about them, all the things that Bill Veeck did, including at one point bringing a little person to the plate, shooting off fireworks, doing all these crazy promotions. So I really wanted to use him as a character, and I thought I was going to write about the Browns, but then I saw the integration work that Bill Veeck had done with the Indians, the Cleveland Indians, and that really led me to this team.
Well, I love the way you framed the story through the eyes of these four guys: Bill Veeck, Bob Feller, who was a national hero for many years, Larry Doby, the second black player in Major League Baseball, and then Satchel Paige, a veteran of the Negro Leagues, who was just hoping to someday get a chance at the majors. And what's among the many fascinating things about your book is the realization that this 1948 World Series, even though the four of them had very different experiences, it would in many ways be the peak for them. None of them would ever achieve that level of success again.
Yeah, the original title of the book was The First Fine Careless Rapture, which is a phrase that Bill Veeck used whenever he described that team. It was, in a sense, the top of the mountain for them, the first time that they had, all four of these men had achieved that success, and they would chase it for the rest of their lives, never to really recapture it. And I wanted to sort of focus on these four of them because they're unlikely individuals to come together. You have two white men in Bill Veeck and Bob Feller. You have two black men in Larry Doby and Satchel Paige. And I thought that they each represented a different facet of the integration experience that was going on at that time. Bill Veeck more progressive, Bob Feller more traditional. Larry Doby and Satchel Paige were about 17 years apart in age. And so they're sort of different generations of Negro League players at that time. And so these are very unlikely individuals to be coming together with very different personalities and experiences. But really, it's through sort of the melding of them that got Cleveland to the championship. They all needed each other in the end.
Well, the connections between two of these four, Bob Feller and Satchel Paige, go back a dozen years before that championship season. And you really set the tone wonderfully with the story of this barnstorming tour that pitted the veteran Satchel Paige against the young fireballer from Van Meter, Iowa.
Yeah, so barnstorming was an activity that was done in the age before television as a way for major leaguers to sort of make a little bit more money in the off-season. These contests would happen immediately after the season ended. So these were talking about sort of October, maybe into early November. And they could do it for about a month before the weather really turned bad. And because these were exhibition games, they could do things that you normally couldn't do in the major leagues. And of course, the major leagues are segregated at this time. So really the only time whenever someone like Bob Feller would be able to face off against players from the Negro Leagues would be during these barnstorming tours when all white teams would compete against all black teams. And Bob Feller was the best white pitcher of his time. He was a sensation. He came out of the cornfields of Iowa and really set the country on fire from very early age. He makes the major leagues at age 17. And Satchel Paige was a sensation in the Negro Leagues. He's the best black pitcher of his time. And so them sort of combining forces was a way to excite crowd interest and, of course, make more money for themselves by swelling the gate receipts. And so Bob Feller and Satchel Paige were seeking each other out in the offseason. We're sort of doing these elaborate barnstorming tours that spanned the country as a way to line their own pockets, basically.
Well, and you point out that they were a real study in contrast. Feller, very much a man of his times in Depression-era America, even if some of it may have been embellished a bit, but the story of the young farm boy who learned to pitch on the farm and the baseball field that his dad carved out of the farmland, that was a message that resonated with a lot of poor people in America, that this guy could, as the saying went, pull himself up by his bootstraps and experience success to the point where his high school graduation, you write, was even aired live on NBC Radio.
From coast to coast, it was indeed. Bob Feller was the quintessential white superstar of his time. He comes from a farm in rural Iowa. His dad senses an ability in him from a very early age, and so he takes sort of a part of his farmland, clears it out of crops, and creates a sort of baseball diamond there that his son then can use as almost like an incubator. It's kind of the original Field of Dreams. Mm. Through happenstance, Feller makes it onto the Indians roster at age 17, and in his very first major league start ever, he ties the American League record in strikeouts, and then four starts later, he ties the major league record in strikeouts. He is just a sensation. He seems to represent this sort of idea that the American dream is, in fact, still alive and well, and it's in the youth, the younger sort of people of the time. And so he becomes this symbol of the American spirit amid the Depression. And I think that you could also look at someone like Satchel Paige, who comes out of the Deep South, where segregation is just a way of life for a black individual like him, and he's impoverished and things like that, and he sort of finds his way into the Negro Leagues and turns himself into a sort of almost like one-man show. He would go around to other teams and pitch for them on a game-by-game basis and pocket some of the gate receipts. He was roaming all around the country and into Latin America during a time when travel and other sorts of things like this is greatly restricted for black citizens of the United States. And so he, too, becomes this sort of symbol among black Americans of mobility and defiance and self-determination. So Feller and Paige really were resonant among their respective races at that time.
And Paige, the biggest draw on the barnstorming circuit, and seen as an entertainer by many, but he always said he was very serious and was very serious about pitching. But even people like Larry Doby in later years would look back at some of Paige's antics and talk about it as really some of those stereotypes, a step and fetch it approach.
Yeah, Satchel Paige, he was quite older than Larry Doby. He gets his start in the Negro Leagues in the late 20s and really kind of flowers during those early years of the Depression. This is a time whenever Jim Crow laws and segregation are just rampant across the land, and he has to sort of figure out a way to navigate them, and he sort of affects a persona that he walked really slowly to the mound. He had a sort of deadpan demeanor. He told quite humorous and elaborate stories to the press and fans and things like this. And white fans in particular sort of detected traces of the actor Stepan, or the character Stepan Fetchit within him, which Paige didn't necessarily play down, but once he got on the mound, he was completely all business. He was not on that mound to clown around or to put on any sort of circus act. He was there to win baseball games. So he had a sort of way about him of navigating those spaces that sort of put white fans at ease, but also then astonished them by his extraordinary skill and ability on the mound. But as that got, as time wore on and sort of World War II came and went, that sort of mode of being fell out of favor. And Larry Doby sort of looked at Satchel Paige as someone who was perhaps a little bit undignified or played to stereotypes among white fans. And that is exactly what he did not want to do. And so Paige and Doby did not, in fact, get along.
We're talking with Luke Eplin about his book, Our Team. Bill Veeck had grown up and had been exposed to baseball. His dad was involved in minor league baseball as a young man. He bought the Milwaukee Brewers, and even then we saw some of the signs of his flamboyant nature and his work as an entertainer as well, realizing that you needed more than just a baseball game to draw people to the ballpark.
Right. Bill Veeck sort of cultivated this idea of a baseball game as almost like a theatrical experience. You could have competitive play on the field among the players. But then you could also have sort of diverting sideshows before the games, between innings, and after the games that could go hand-in-hand with that competitive play. So even on a game whenever your team lost or perhaps didn't perform up to expectations, fans could still go home thinking that they were entertained, they got their money's worth, etc. And this was quite a sensation back in the 30s and 40s whenever Bill Beck was first starting out. He would do elaborate things like give away livestock or giant kegs of nails, big blocks of ice. He would shoot off fireworks. He would marry people at home plate. He would have circus performers on the field. Things that nowadays we might think of as par for the course when going to a stadium, but at that time was not really known. In fact, I do believe that he is kind of the father of the modern stadium experience. Anytime you go to a stadium and you see cap dances or mascot races or fireworks, those are really Bill Veeck's fingerprints that you're seeing.
World War II had a big impact on the participants, including three of your principals who were involved in the war, Bill Veeck suffering a serious injury there as well, but also post-war had a huge impact on baseball. We had seen, I think, more of a push for integration in the post-war years because after blacks and whites had fought together to save the world against fascism in Europe, it was a little hard to segregate, or at least it didn't go down as easily after that. And the push grew for integrating Major League Baseball. But everybody had a different approach to this. I thought it was interesting that someone like Larry Doby didn't know much about Major League Baseball because he had grown up following the Negro Leagues, and that was his greatest aspiration in many ways.
Yeah, it's interesting. Doby has a story that he grew up in South Carolina and moved to Paterson, New Jersey as a young man. And in his high school years, he went to an integrated high school, and he was quite simply a sensation. He was the captain of a football team that won the state championship. He got a basketball scholarship to one of the powerhouse programs in the nation. And he was a baseball player who was so good that he made the Negro Leagues at the age of 18. He really did kind of feel that sort of exceptionalism in sports, even though he did, you know, have to deal with slights and slurs and other sorts of things like that from the fans, but that exceptionalism sort of allowed him to feel like an accepted member of those communities. Whenever he gets drafted into the Navy, he gets on a train in Newark and is going to Chicago where he's going to do his training. And there are black and white recruits on this train, and he's looking at them, and he recognizes some of them from athletes or people that he knew in high school, and he's thinking, oh, well, we're all going to go to the same place. We're all going to be together like a sports team, like what he was used to. And when he gets there, the Navy separates the white recruits from the black recruits, and it really is the first time that segregation just hits Doby hard. This is the same country that he is going to fight for, and they are treating him as a second-class citizen right off the bat. And so really that's his sort of introduction to segregation.
Now for Bob Feller, along with seeing significant action on board the Alabama, he also was concerned that he had lost a fair amount of potential income in his peak years. And so when he got back from the war, one of the first things he did was to really pick up the pace of barnstorming. And that got him back together with Satchel Paige once again on tours that really showcased black talent on the one hand. But at the same time, Feller would tell anybody who would listen that he wasn't sure that even the best of the Negro League players could compete at the major league level.
Feller is a complicated figure. He was somebody who had no problem competing against the best black athletes around and exposing himself to defeat. He often got defeated by Satchel Paige, including on the one that you're referring to, this 1946 barnstorming tour, where they play something like 35 games in 28 days. They're just flying across the country competing against each other. And really, because these tours were drawing tens of thousands of fans, they're exposing players like Paige and Buck O'Neill and other players like this to white fans, sports writers, and executives who otherwise would not have seen a Negro League baseball game. So it's really sort of showcasing the talent of these individuals, and they're playing against Feller. He's got like Stan Musial on his team. He's got all of these great players on there, and Paige's team is beating them. And so really it helped the cause of integration quite a lot. But anytime Feller was asked, basically, from the 30s until baseball was integrated in 1947, major leagues were integrated in 1947, if any black players had what it took to make it in the majors, he would invariably say no. He felt like they were quite skilled in many ways, but they didn't sort of combine the overall package that would you would need to be a major league player. And in a way, he's kind of thinking of this from a very individual standpoint, as in, I made it to the major leagues as a 17-year-old. I pulled myself up out of the farm. I worked hard. I sort of perfected my craft, et cetera. They should be able to do that as well. And the fact that they haven't must mean that they're not good enough. He's sort of blinded himself to the structural barriers that prevented black players from having a similar narrative as his own.
Bill Veeck would eventually bring all of them together. And I love the story of Veeck going on a scouting mission of sorts. He had his eye on some teams, the Pittsburgh Pirates among them, but it was spending time in Cleveland and really spending time with the people, going into bars and taverns, talking to people on the street, that convinced him that this was really an opportunity waiting to happen.
Bill Veeck was a man of the people. He was a populist. He might have been born rich. He might have been born into a wealthy family, but he was somebody who wanted to sit in the bleachers and not in an owner's box. He was somebody who did not wear suits and ties and hats and things like this. He dressed like a common individual. And so whenever he goes to look for a major league club to buy in 1946, he's not going to the sort of high society places to figure out the sort of financials or anything like that. He's going into bars and talking to people and saying, what do you think of the Indians? What do you think about the baseball team? And what he sees is in Cleveland is that these are fans that are passionate about baseball, but they feel disconnected from the ownership team, which the ownership group of the Indians, which has exerted very little effort into drawing them to the ballpark or, frankly, rebuilding the roster into a championship club. But he sees to himself, heck, if somebody reaches out to these fans, we could fill this massive stadium that Cleveland has on the lakefront. It is a stadium of 78,000 people, and it was very rarely ever got above, say, 20,000 in that stadium. And Veeck is thinking to himself, boy, wouldn't it be great if we could try to fill that thing? So yeah, he senses something in the air. Cleveland is the place for him.
He signed Larry Doby in 1947, handled him carefully, didn't get a lot of action that year. He grudgingly kept on player-manager Lou Boudreau in that position, and then the 1948 yeah. season began. And I felt like I knew my baseball, but I didn't know this at all, that when Feller struggled, the fans, not just in Cleveland, but everywhere, turned against him and blamed Bob Feller's, I guess, greed out there doing the barnstorming tours for his disappointing performance on the field.
Bob Feller was somebody who always seemed to adapt to the times. So he was the sort of all-American boy in the Depression. He was the war hero during the war, signing up for the war whenever he didn't have to, setting a good example for other boys to follow. And then when he comes back from the war in 1946, he sort of becomes almost like the man in the white flannel suits. He becomes kind of an entrepreneur. He is the first professional athlete to incorporate himself. And as long as he's winning games and sort of his on-field performance is doing okay, fans were going with it. 1947 and 1948, he really starts to struggle for the first time ever in his athletic career. And now fans turn on him and say, he's greedy. He's thinking only of his bottom line instead of the standings. He is too occupied. His mind is not where it needs to be. I think it's something that you see nowadays as well. Anytime an athlete seems to be not performing up to his or her capabilities, and you see a commercial with that athlete or something like that, or you see them in the tabloids, they'll say, oh, he's too preoccupied with X, Y, and Z. Feller certainly fell prey to that, to the extent where Indians fans were booing him quite vociferously.
Satchel Paige had waited for years and years to get his opportunity and wondered, as did friends, if he was just too old to ever get his chance at the major leagues. But finally, he came to the rescue. Bill Veeck reached out, and they had communications earlier with Satchel asking him, when will I get the chance? And Veeck sent word that now's the time, and Paige helped save that 1948 season for them.
Yeah, it really is quite something that Feller and Page, these two players who had been barnstorming against each other for 12 years at that point, by 1948, that Page, who was 42 years old and has been waiting forever to get into the majors, really gets his opportunity because Feller struggles so badly in that 1948 season. The Indians are neck and neck in the pennant race, and Beck realizes we need more pitching if we're going to be able to do it. Where can he find it? Well, he's been looking at Satchel Paige for as long as Feller has been barnstorming with him. Like, Beck knows what Satchel Paige is capable of. And whenever Paige comes onto the Indians in July of 1948, he really sets off a nationwide sort of frenzy. Everywhere he goes, fans are just literally tearing out the turnstiles to get the chance to see him. He is setting attendance records every night that he starts. It's like a mythic figure has come into the league. Things that even if a lot of white fans had not seen him pitch, his name by that point, because of all the reports and sort of tales that had circulated about him, was known by people. And now you finally got a chance to see him.
The Indians end up tying the Red Sox for first place in the 1948 regular season and had to go to a one-game playoff. And, of course, here in New England, 70-some years later, people are still saying, why Denny Gailhouse?
It is a curious choice. Denny Gailhouse was a pitcher for the Red Sox. He'd also pitched on the Browns and several other teams, including the Indians at one point. He was a veteran starter who earlier in 1948 for the Red Sox had completely shut the Indians down during a crucial game, I believe in July. And so the manager kind of rolled the dice and thought maybe Gailhouse would be able to contain them. But honestly, nobody could really contain Lou Boudreau that season. He ended up hitting a pair of home runs in that game. He was a sensation. He won the MVP. Bill Veeck almost got rid of him in the off season, and he really pulled them through. So it was the Indians, perhaps fate to win that.
They would meet the Boston Braves in the World Series, and among the many ironies is the fact that Bob Feller was completely ineffective in the World Series. Satchel Paige was a non-factor, finally getting in mop-up duty along the way, and it would be Larry Doby, who had struggled to find his place at various times as a major league ball player, who proved to be the offensive hero and then an unlikely pitching star in knuckleballer Gene Bearden.
Yeah, I think that really the Larry Doby's journey in 1947 and 1948 is one of the most extraordinary stories in Major League Baseball history. Unlike Jackie Robinson, who was the first black player in Major League Baseball in the 20th century, Robinson had a year in the minor leagues to kind of acclimate, to get his footing. Larry Doby journeyed literally overnight from the Negro Leagues to the Indians. He plays on the Negro Leagues one night, he's on the Indians the next day. He is so sort of shell-shocked by joining the majors so suddenly in 1947 that he would tell reporters that when he would come up to bat, his teeth were chattering. Mm. And so he has a very poor 1947 season. He barely gets any playing time. People do not think he's going to make the team in 1948. He claws his way under the roster in spring training. He has a kind of up and down first half of the season. And Lou Boudreau is continually saying to himself, maybe we should send him down. Maybe he needs more seasoning. But every time Boudreau does that, Doby has this sort of incredible home run, or he does this incredible play in the field. They eventually decide, let's just keep him up here. And it really pays off. Doby ends up hitting over 300 for that season. And then in the World Series, he leads all Indians batters with a .318 average and has a home run in the fourth game that gives the Indians the victory. And that is really the crucial game of that series. And so really, Larry Doby goes from sort of a bench warmer to a superstar just like that. And it really sort of opens Major League executives' eyes to what can happen if you sign players from the Negro Leagues, because surely the Indians would not have even come close to the World Series if they hadn't had Larry Doby.
There are a couple of incredibly poignant moments in the book after the Indians win the World Championship, one being Bill Veeck's comment that He had never been so lonely. His son had come to the game, and that was a disappointing experience. His wife was getting ready to divorce him. And then just a breathtaking moment on the page with Bob Feller over on one side of the clubhouse, head down, not even looking to make eye contact with his teammates because of his own disappointment with his performance, and Larry Doby crossing that room to go over and shake his hand.
Larry Doby had had a very rough introduction to the Indians. Whenever he came onto the team, as I said, it was overnight. The other Indians players were not prepared for that, and some of them did not shake his hand whenever he comes into the clubhouse to join the Indians in 1947. He would always remember that moment throughout the rest of his life and this sort of sting of not being accepted into the major leagues. So in the World Series, whenever Bob Feller loses two games, sort of the World Series was really the last thing that Bob Feller hadn't done. He was such an incredible pitcher who had all of these accolades, but he'd never won a game in the World Series, and he finally makes it there, and he loses both of his games. And it's really Larry Doby who is the hero. And what I found so touching about that scene in the clubhouse after the Indians win the World Series is Bob Feller is in a corner, sort of by himself with his head down. And he was the star of the Indians for so long, and now he's kind of an overlooked figure. People are not seeking him out. And it's really Doby, the one who is so sensitive to exclusion and loneliness and being that person in the corner like that in an all-white clubhouse, who sees Feller and goes over to him and sort of shakes his hand. He does the gesture that he wanted people to do for him. It's a really touching scene.
Absolutely. I wanted to talk, Luke, about a couple of people you talked to in your wonderful and extensive research on the book, and one of them is Eddie Robinson, who was a member of that 1948 team. What was that experience like for you?
Eddie Robinson right now is 100 years old. He lives in Texas. I spoke to him, I think, 2 years ago. He invited me into his house. He's the only living member of the 1948 Indians, and he has a mind that he can remember specific at-bats whenever he was on the team. And so it was really valuable to get an insider perspective on what it was like when the Indians integrated. And he was somebody who was really struggling to stay on the field. He was a first baseman. It was his sort of rookie year in 1947 whenever Larry Doby comes on. And Doby replaces Eddie Robinson in one game at first base.
Right.
And Eddie Robinson was so upset that he quit the team and said, well, if this is how it's going to be, then I just don't want to be here. And he has to be talked back onto the team. And I think that has shadowed him throughout his entire life, the fact that something like that happens. And he was very sort of insistent when I talked to him that it did not have to do with racism. It had to do with the fact that that he was somebody who had been told that he was going to be the first baseman for the Indians, and now he is losing out playing time to somebody who had just been onto the team. But I think what it mainly shows is just how for certain sort of white players that were struggling, the sort of integration to them could register as a loss of status or a loss of playing time or they could lose, they could be sent to the minors because of someone like Doby being on the team and what a threat that represented. So to get that perspective from Eddie Robinson was valuable.
He also talked to the great Jim Mudcat Grant, the first black pitcher to win 20 games, who was a teammate of Larry Doby's later in his career. And of course, Jim Mudcat Grant passed away just last week.
He did. Mudcat did several conversations with me for this book. I think the most interesting thing that he was telling me was that he was Larry Doby had gotten traded by the Indians in the mid-50s to the White Sox, but then he came back to the Indians in 1958, and that happened to be Jim Mudcat Grant's rookie season, and they roomed together in spring training that year. And Mudcat talked about how Larry Doby really took him under his wing and sort of showed him the places that a black player could and couldn't go in Tucson, Arizona at that time, and really how to sort of navigate these spaces that they were in. And Mudcat also talked about how Doby, whenever the sort of slurs and racial abuses that he was getting from the stands or even from the clubhouse would pile up, they'd be in their room together, and Doby would just start throwing his shoes or screaming at the TV or something. And he said that Mudcat said that it was always sort of, you couldn't take it out face-to-face with these people. And so you would just be in the room, turn up the TV, and that's where you would sort of take out your anger. So getting that perspective from him was also really valuable.
I had the opportunity about 20 years ago now to meet Larry Doby when he helped induct his friend Jerry Eisenberg into the National Sportscasters and Sportswriters Hall of Fame. And he was an incredible man with so much strength and grace.
He was. He was a man of great dignity. He was a man who was, I think, a very sensitive individual. And he was very misunderstood at the time. And you could, I mean, there's one sort of section in the book where Larry Doby is going to spring training in 1948. He is in Tucson. He is the only black player on the Indians at that point. He is separated from his teammates because he can't stay in the same hotel. He is getting abuse in the stadiums that they are traveling to play exhibition games. And he feels really like he's disconnected. And at the same time, he is performing extraordinarily well, to the point where people that thought he could never make that team after his poor season in 1947 were like, this must be one of the most exciting times in your life. And Doby does this interview in 1948 where he's just talking about how lonely he is and how the loneliness is infecting him and sort of causing sort of just extreme discomfort and things like this. And it is one of the most honest things that I've ever seen an athlete say. Just, he wore those emotions sort of on the sleeve, and you can tell that the white sports writer interviewing him is not equipped really to sort of deal with those emotions or even what is causing them. But he is, Doby himself was just so honest and articulate in it. It was a real education for me to research his life.
The book is called Our Team, the epic story of four men in the World Series that changed baseball. It's a remarkable story of both baseball and America at an important time in our history. Luke Eplin, thank you so much. I love the book. Thanks for making time to talk about it with us today.
Thanks, Rich. It was great.